Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and today we are going to be talking about the government's National Tutoring Programme, the scheme which is designed to help children catch up at school after COVID has had such a disruptive effect on education, and where the money is actually going to be going to. Spoiler alert, not actually going directly to the children or even the schools themselves. And later in the programme, we will be talking to Francis Ween and Ian Hislop about Robert Maxwell. Robert Maxwell, for those of you who are not familiar with him, is one of the Eye's greatest ever enemies. He was a businessman, MP, charlatan, fraudster and crook who died in 1991 and has since been having a remarkable comeback. There is a new book, a new podcast, a new everything about him. He is back in the news, and so I sat down with Francis and Ian to have a little chat about the Eye's memories of Mr. Maxwell. But first, education, education, education. The National Tutoring Programme is the government's flagship scheme designed to offer post-lockdown catch-up tutoring to children who need it. Obviously, thousands of children across the country have had their educations severely disrupted by COVID-19 and by learning from home. The money that's being put into it sounds very impressive, £350 million. But as ever, with this government, there are questions over exactly how that money is being distributed, who it's going to, and how the whole scheme is being managed. Jane McKenzie is Private Eye's education correspondent, among many other things, and I had a chat with her about just how the scheme is being run and what it's aiming to achieve. Here's Jane.
So the tutoring programme is aimed to help those kids who've been particularly affected by lack of access to teaching and get them sort of caught up on the concepts and information they've missed out on. You know, on one level, that all sounds terribly positive.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good thing to be helping kids. One of the biggest issues that sort of head teachers and schools and so on have is that the money isn't going where you'd expect it to go, which is to them, to help.
Yes.
They're the people best placed to decide what the kids in front of them need to catch up. But the way the funding for the National Tutoring Programme is being provided is a very contorted route where instead of the money going to the schools, it goes to a sort of group of private companies who've been selected by a consortium of charities. And those companies are then able to offer a subsidised reduced rate to the schools to hire in tutors from those companies as an agency to come and teach small groups of children in their schools.
Wow.
So creating a completely unnecessary middleman or set of middle people.
As you say, it might have been simpler just to say to every school affected, we're going to give you a set amount of money depending on how many pupils you have assessed need this catching up program. Maybe there are some schools where everyone is the child of a key worker and schooling has continued more normally. And maybe there are some schools where everyone's been at home and there's a lot of catching up to do. So, you know, there might have to be some kind of way of working that out. But that's not what you're saying has happened. And the money here is £350 million. So it's a reasonable amount to spend.
Well, it's split into tranches. So there's one which goes to this tuition partners scheme, which is where they create a subsidy system where the money goes to the companies so that they can offer a cut rate price to the schools. There seems to be just a route for money to just depart from the tuition provision. So you give the money to a company so that it can offer schools a cut rate. But one of the things we're writing about this time is the companies are advertising the amount they're paying to tutors. And they also list the price they charge to schools. So we can see the sometimes quite large difference in this. You know, there is a cost to running a tutoring agency. You have to employ the people there who make the arrangements for the tutors to go into schools. But is a very significant gap between what they're paying the tutors, which is what the schools could have paid the tutors sort of directly, and the cost of employing a tutor through an agency on a subsidised rate, but at such a high unsubsidised rate that the subsidised rate doesn't seem very cheap.
And you mentioned this in your article in the latest issue of the magazine. The discount will be up to 75% off the usual rate that this private tuition firm normally charges. That's the discount you can get, which sounds like a really good deal for schools to get. But you're saying that the amount these firms normally charge is so much higher than what you would pay for a teacher or a tutor or whoever, that actually it might shake out at roughly the same or not an especially good deal for these schools?
Yeah. So at this 75% off rate, it sort of works out not dissimilar to what if a school was to do the organising itself, it could find some tutors to come in for. In fact, some schools use volunteers who come in and do reading schemes and the like, and that obviously costs them significantly less, but
yeah,
they're not usually qualified people. But then neither is everybody on this tuition scheme. If you actually wanted a properly, fully qualified teacher to come in on a supply teacher rate, that offers up so many options for what you could use them for too, because they could, you could split a class in half and, you know, provide two different sets of lessons for a class that were small class size by doing that. That would cost not dissimilar to what getting somebody in to do one-to-one from a tuition agency would cost. And that's at the 75% subsidy, which is going to tail off pretty quickly next year. So they will have a 50% subsidy for a period and then go down to like a 10% subsidy. Well, at which point it's a very expensive way. It still might be a very effective way for some kids, but it's not going to be a cost-effective catch-up for millions of children.
Hmm. And the numbers that you give in the article, so some small group tutoring prices that these firms are charging can be up to about £90 an hour. So in a couple of years, once this discount has tapered off to 10%, schools would be paying £81 an hour for a tutor's time to tutor a small group or one-on-one. That obviously is not what the tutor themselves gets paid. You know, there's a big difference, and that difference is the money that goes to the company. So you also mentioned that lots of heads are opting out of this scheme, that they're not taking up the National Tutoring Programme on its offer of discounted tutoring for budget reasons in the first place.
Yes. So not all schools can afford to buy extra tutoring at any amount. They're barely managing to sort of pay for pens and pencils. So they get some extra catch-up funding to spend, and they're being encouraged to spend it on buying things in from the National Tutoring Programme. But that's certainly not what a lot of heads think is the best use of that money.
And do heads have discretion over how they spend that money?
Yes. I think in some parts of the country, there's more of a tradition of getting extra tutoring and a sense that sort of parents have bought tutoring for kids in the past. And some parts of the country, that's a fairly alien concept. You get your schooling at school, and at most you might get music lessons outside of school, but you don't also go to like a Wednesday night French class and that kind of extra tutoring. So there hasn't been the same buy-in in some parts of the country into using this scheme anyway.
So presumably that will only exacerbate the differences between schools all over the country. It feels like a very fragmented way of running this thing. And obviously education is huge and complicated when you've got this many schools in the country, but it feels confusing.
Government are sort of making lots of announcements about the spending, and it all sounds terrific that we're throwing, you know, an extra $200 million at this problem. That sounds excellent. That's going to help with catch up, but it's certainly not helping evenly or necessarily in the most focused way, because it's all about what schools, different schools and different companies buy into to help out. So, you know, children's experience of coming out of this year is going to be very, very varied.
These private tuition companies obviously have been operating in what they're used to as the normal marketplace, where some parents or I guess some schools have been buying their services in the past. But doesn't this really change what is required of these companies? I mean, to organise this kind of huge national catching up thing, they're going to require many more tutors than they've had in the past, working very different hours. Is there a massive recruitment drive going on to get all these extra tutoring hours?
There certainly has been advertising going on for extra tutors.
Should we be setting up a tutoring company right now, is my question.
I think there may be money in it.
It's supporting the private tuition industry, but maybe not giving schools exactly what they need.
Yeah. And one of the things that both the organisers of the tutoring programme and ministers keep mentioning is, well, there's evidence that tutoring in one-to-one or small groups will catch children up 3 to 5 months at a time. Now, that's a phrase that makes very little sense. per class? That's very effective. No.
Yeah.
As far as the evidence I've been able to find is, what they mean is per year. So some studies have found that kids who were having private tuition got basically a year and 3 months worth of education in a year.
Okay. Oh, well, that's a good.
That sounds good. You know. That's moving them forwards.
Yeah.
But very little of that research has ever been done on missed schooling due to a pandemic. So in the past, children have been more likely to do extra tuition because perhaps they were struggling to keep up or, so the one-to-one would help them with some concepts they'd not grasped or some extra practice, which is very different from first-time teaching of a subject, which is what children have missed out on by not being in school. So it's not the same as, let's go over this topic you'd already done in class.
Right.
So there's actually very little research on
how
effective tutoring would be for this kind of catch-up. Perhaps a little bit for youngsters who've missed school because of serious illness for a period.
Yeah.
But again, their situation's quite different. They've missed school while being really poorly, not while trying their best to do some work on the internet. And
And it doesn't feel like that's anyone's fault. It just feels like, obviously, this situation has never come up, so we just don't know. And it's kind of a best guess that, obviously, in general, focused or one-on-one tuition seems likelier to...
It's likely to help.
Yeah. Well, that's
we just
something.
Don't really know how much, or whether it's the best way to help, or whether trying to create smaller class sizes so that you can teach subjects more quickly would be a more effective use of an extra adult. I mean, that's basically what you're providing with a tutor, but you're limiting them to taking 1 to 3 pupils at a time.
It's hard to know, obviously, whether this is going to work. It doesn't seem like there's an obvious better way forward at the moment. Could this project be changed now? It feels like it's in motion. It feels like it's not going to be changed now.
I think in terms of the funding split in what catch-up money has been provided, you could give more of it to heads to make decisions about the children they know and have in front of them on what's the best way to spend it. They then might buy in tutors for the youngsters they think actually really would benefit from that. But you could, instead of splitting the money 75% to a business, and you could just give them 100% of the money, and then they wouldn't need to buy it subsidized because they'd have the whole lump of funding in the first place.
Very interesting. I mean, it's kind of like they've said, look, we're going to set up a shop which has lots of tutors in it, and we're going to give you fabulous vouchers, but the shop is a really expensive boutique one that they wouldn't ordinarily be shopping at. And
that's a perfect way of describing it, really. Yes. You're offering people a limited selection of very expensive items, but helping them a bit to buy it.
Yeah. There's a famine, so we're going to open a Waitrose, but we're going to give you some money off vouchers for the Waitrose.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I can't see this not working. Thank you to Jane McKenzie there. And you can read more about that in the latest edition of the magazine, on sale now. And there will doubtless be more stories in the fortnights ahead on the same subject. Now, we turn to Robert Maxwell, who was in life an MP, a publisher, a newspaper magnate, in fact, who owned the Mirror group of newspapers. He was a businessman and also a charlatan. In life, he spoke a great deal about how the press couldn't be gagged and how important freedom of the press was. He also spent a great deal of his time suing people who said anything disobliging about him. Maxwell died in 1991, falling off his yacht, the Lady Ghislaine, shortly before an enormous hole in the Mirror's pension fund was revealed, a hole that Maxwell himself had created by stealing money from the pensioners of his own workers. Maxwell is back in the news not only because of the forthcoming trial of his daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, but because there's a new book out about him, there's a new podcast, and there are documentaries in the works too. Maxwell's life is being treated as ancient history in a lot of ways, but there are plenty of people on Fleet Street who remember standing up to Maxwell at the time. Actually, there are not that many people who remember standing up to Maxwell, because not many people did. He was incredibly intimidating and sued anyone at the drop of a hat. I spoke to Francis Ween and Ian Hislop, who respectively wrote and edited and published a lot of the articles about Maxwell which prompted lawsuits, and I started off by asking Ian exactly what it was like going up against Maxwell himself in court. Here's Ian.
I have very vivid memories of watching him in court, not only standing in the dock, but sitting there in the front talking to his lawyers. And he was always smiling. And I got this bizarre sense that not only did he really enjoy the fight, but he quite fancied being us. He had a feeling he might have been on the wrong side. So it was very peculiar. He was very threatening. I mean, he's an enormous man. His war record always suggested to me that he'd quite like to kill all of us. And certainly if we'd surrendered, that might have been what happened. But he was very, very worrying. When he was in court, he could absolutely turn it on. So he would beam a smile at our lawyer or me or whoever appeared, and then he would go in the dock and weep and say he'd never been so hurt in his entire life as by this piece. So he was an extraordinary force.
And we should say this wasn't just one piece that he sued over. There were many, many times where you would have been where you would have had a chance to see him turning it on in court. And Francis, you will have written a lot of these pieces yourself. So did Michael Gillard, Slicker. He did a lot of the Maxwell coverage, didn't he? Can you give us some examples of the kind of things that he did sue the Eye over?
Well, he sued over pretty much everything, or at least tried to injunct us over everything. I think there was even things like John Kent, the cartoonist, did a little drawing of Maxwell, his master's voice type thing, with the little dog, and Neil Kinnock, the Labour leader, as the little puppy dog, and whoop, straight to the lawyers. I mean, anything would get him going. The lookalike thing, he said when we had a lookalike in the letters page of Maxwell and, I think, Ronnie Cray, and he claimed, I think I've got it here somewhere, he said, "Mrs. Maxwell and all of our children were utterly shocked to have me, their father, compared to a convicted major gangster." Can you imagine the idea that Maxwell might be a gangster? I should have thought Ronnie Cray should have sued, frankly, for being compared, likened to Maxwell.
I remember when he sued over the dog cartoon. No one had ever sued over a cartoon before.
Right.
It was another one of Maxwell's firsts. He was one of those people who loved the idea of the British sense of humour, but actually when it came near him, he just couldn't bear it and certainly didn't get it. So he was very, very cross about the jokes. So that was new. Not only could he sue over the allegations of financial impropriety, but he could also sue over any joke about him. So he became just writ mad, really. He sued over everything.
Yeah, and this is what put a lot of people off, isn't it? Covering him, writing any stories about him, you just knew that you would get a writ and that it would then soak up tens of thousands of pounds or hundreds of thousands, and it would take months of time to deal with. And at the end of it, what have you actually got out of it? So most papers seem to have been rather nervous about writing about him.
I think that's right. I mean, occasionally a paper would start looking into Maxwell. I mean, the Sunday Times had a go quite early on, but they got bombarded with writs and decided eventually in the later years it was more trouble than it was worth, as did most papers. And I remember in about 1990 I was doing a weekly page in The Independent on Sunday, and I did quite a few pieces about Maxwell in that, because he was throughout sort of 1990 and 1991 up to his death, he was going into overdrive. I mean, every week he would announce that he was going to finance research to find a cure for AIDS, or he was going to end the toothpaste shortage in Bulgaria, or he was going to form a partnership with Mikhail Gorbachev. I mean, he was always hogging the headlines. And I would then write a piece saying this is complete codswallop. The editor of The Independent on Sunday, Stephen Glover, would sort of sigh and say, "Oh, must you?" And I said, "Yes, it's a very good story. It's all true, and it needs to be written about." He said, "Yes, it may be all true, but you know he'll sue, because he always does, and then we'll be tied up in meetings with lawyers for the next 6 months or a year, and it'll cost us lots of money, and at the end of it, even if we win, we'll have wasted all that time and money. Is it really that important?" I said, "But if we take that attitude, nobody will ever write about him at all. That's what he's banking on." And so actually, to be fair to Glover, he did, with a heavy sigh, usually let me do it. But the eye was the one place where you could be sure that when I went to Ian and said, oh, I've got a story about Maxwell, he would jump for joy and say, goody, put it in.
I think it's because it was 1975 where Maxwell was first quoted as saying, I have shut Private Eye up for good. That made it sort of absolutely irresistible. And when I took over as editor, Ingram had left me a number of charming presents, most of which were writs from Maxwell, which then, like sort of old World War II bombs, exploded in my face at various episodes. But it's interesting, Francis brings up the AIDS thing. I mean, this was Maxwell's idea of a joke. He won some action against the eye and he said, well, I'm going to give the money to AIDS because the eye is a diseased organ, so maybe I can cure it. And you could feel the country cringing, thinking, is that an example of a Maxwell joke? But that was how heavy-handed he was.
And all his promises like that, I mean, the point was they were never followed up, so he got the headlines. I remember, 1990, summer of 1990, Gorbachev was visiting America, and I think the governor of Minnesota was hosting a lunch in his honour. And so Maxwell thought, I can steal the limelight. So he got himself invited and then announced at this lunch that he was going to give $50 million of his own money to set up the Gorbachev-Maxwell Institute for Technology. And he hadn't a clue what it was going to do. He was sort of vaguely muttered about, AIDS, the ozone layer. It'll be, the best thing since the invention of the wheel. He hadn't thought about it at all. So he hogged all the limelight and Gorbachev was hardly noticed. And then when he came back, I started regularly ringing the governor of Minnesota's office saying, now, how is this going, this institute? We haven't really got very far so far. We're trying to find an idea for what on earth this thing can do. And has Mr. Maxwell's money come through? Well, no, it hasn't come through yet. Now you mentioned it, but he has promised us £50 million, $50 million. And of course it never arrived. And of course the whole thing was a stunt. But mostly people didn't follow up those sorts of things.
It sounds, I mean, just listening to the way you guys are speaking about him now, you know, announcing enormous expensive projects which never actually materialise, suing everyone, there is something extremely Trumpian. As in, listeners to this will, I'm sure, be thinking of Donald Trump and his completely untethered relationship with reality. It sounds like Maxwell could have gone that way.
That's a good comparison. And Maxwell did become an MP, and at various points he had desire, I think, for political influence, but he was just too inept. He didn't have Trump's instincts, even his worst instincts.
Well, their paths did cross a bit. When Maxwell, a year or so before he died, went to New York and bought the New York Daily News, and Trump had been very keen to buy the New York Daily News over the years. I mean, they had the same approach. You know, we could buy a paper like that and really make a splash in the Big Apple. And when Maxwell bought the Daily News, he was suddenly all over the telly in America, and he succeeded Trump as New York's most famous businessman for a while. And Trump refused to come to the party celebrating. Maxwell had a party on his yacht on the Lady Gilles Lane, and Trump had actually been to a party the previous year on the Lady Gilles Lane, but he decided to boycott this one because he was in a sulk that Maxwell had got the paper and he hadn't.
Gosh.
They are phenomenally similar. I mean, I think it surprises us that Maxwell has now had a revival as the father of Ghislaine, and somehow his fame rests on being related to her. But he was a completely all-pervasive bullying thug through the 80s and 90s. And the revival of interest, both Francis and I think, were rather shocked at the rather cuddly figure that is being presented as though it was all a laugh and everyone knew all along and it was all very amusing. And I mean, it became funny because it was so mad, but everybody went along with it. And it wasn't just other newspapers, it was lawyers, financiers, businessmen, wasn't it, Francis? Oh, yeah. Everyone was making money out of him, so no one wanted to rock the boat.
Well, even to the extent that I remember when The Independent was starting in 1986, and Andreas Whittam Smith, the founding editor, was saying, we're going to be different, we're going to be purer than pure, we're not going to have some big bad baron owning us. And then discovered that secretly Maxwell had acquired some of the shares in The Independent through various cutouts and front companies and front men and things. And Andreas was appalled. He said, "This is exactly the sort of person we've promised we're not going to have owning the paper." So they had to then negotiate with Maxwell to persuade him to sell back his shares so they could sell them to somebody nice.
Was there a kind of... I mean, he was a newspaper proprietor. Was there a sense that that helped other newspapers not cover him? Because there has been a kind of omerta, you know, code of silence between different proprietors over the years, which the Eye's covered a lot.
I think that that's absolutely true. And I think there was a sense of, we don't mind a few amusing stories about him going in, but any sense of the sort of digging Francis was doing and then Slicker did and we did more of was, well, what if that starts happening to me? I don't want anyone looking at my tax arrangements or at my intercompany loan policy. So I think proprietors and, you know, with pressure on their editors, thought it was better not to do this stuff. But again, you know, back in the 70s, he'd been judged unfit to run a public company. And yet somehow he had survived that QC's investigation and prospered. So the idea that it was some surprise at the end that he'd been a crook all along seemed to me ludicrous, because we all knew that.
Well, my favourite one of those was Paul Johnson, who at the time was the main YOY writer on the leader page in the Daily Mail, a great sort of thunderous pundit, wrote a thing in the Mail saying, "YOY, did no one realise that Maxwell was a crook? Or when he had 'this man is a crook' practically tattooed on his forehead, it was so obvious, everyone knew he was a crook, but why did nobody say so?" And this same Paul Johnson, in 1984, when Maxwell bought the Daily Mirror and there were various people saying, "But he's a bit of a crook, he shouldn't be allowed to buy it," Paul Johnson wrote a media column saying, "I don't give a damn what some Department of Trade report said years ago. The thing is, Maxwell's a hard man and a good businessman and a sharp eye and a sharp nose for any extravagance. He'll knock them into shape at the Mirror." So, and then 6 or 7 years later, he said, "Why did nobody mention that he was a crook?"
I just felt there was a bit of a sense of that with this new book and this new interest in Maxwell coming out, as though somehow it was a long time ago and actually it was all, well, was he really that bad? And I think the answer is yes, he was that bad. If you look at, say, the campaign against Tom Bauer's biography, and again, Bauer had basically nailed him in a book, particularly his finances. And Maxwell wasn't having it. He wasn't having the book. I mean, he went full on, essentially, to get this book removed and silenced. I mean, it was Andrew Lloyd Webber's greatest hour, wasn't it, Francis? I mean,
Maxwell bought the initial publisher, was then bought by Maxwell as part of his campaign to suppress it. And then Aurum Press, I think it was, Andrew Lloyd Webber stood firm and published it. And Tim Waterston, I think, got sued as well, because Waterston started selling it. And I mean, Maxwell sued everyone. It was like when Goldsmith sued all the news distributors to try and stop them selling the Eye. Maxwell was just firing writs everywhere. Yeah. And also, the people around Maxwell, I mean, they get off rather lightly in the John Preston book, but people like Peter Jay, the former ambassador to Washington and economics journalist, I mean, he was chief of staff, this ridiculous title to Maxwell, made him feel very grand. His main job was to be humiliated. Maxwell would ring him up at 3 a.m. and say, "Jay, what time is it?" "Well, it's 3 a.m, Mr. Maxwell." "Thank you, I just wondered what the time was. I couldn't be bothered to find out." But Jay actually hired private detectives to go and spy on Bauer's house in North London. And they produced all these reports. And they said, "We have asked around and we've been planted in a little van opposite his house and we've been spying on him. He doesn't seem to come and go all that often, but he went out today. We followed him and he went to lunch and we've placed a secret recording device and this, that, the other." I mean, it was a major spying operation, all authorised and paid for by Maxwell and organised by Peter Jay, his chief of staff. But you wouldn't really guess that from the book. It's... comical figure of Peter Jay was his chief of staff and then escaped and went off to the BBC to be economics editor without a stain on his character.
Francis, you actually made a documentary, a half-hour documentary, about Maxwell's legal history after his death. And you interviewed a lot of the people who had suffered on the end of it. You know, Tim Waterstone, who'd been bullied out of selling the book, and Tom Bauer, who'd written the book in the first place. All these people who had done their best at the time to resist this legal blizzard.
Yes, well, it was a sequel, in fact, because I did a film the year before for BBC Two, for The Late Show, about Maxwell's behaviour in Eastern Europe, his sucking up to, fawning over all these dictators and then doing business deals with them. And he went berserk, as he always does. And he went on, he was on the Wogan chat show, and he said, I have been told by my lawyers that I could get £1 million in damages from Mr. Ween and the BBC, but I don't need £1 million, which was true, actually. He needed about 500 million, I think. But but he said instead he was demanding and got a right of reply. So we said, that's fine. So he was offered that he could come on telly and, for the equivalent length of time, defend his record in Eastern Europe, and then he and I would have a live debate. And I was looking forward to it so much. And every few weeks, we'd get a message saying, right, put this in your diary. His office has agreed that he'll do it on, you know, the 3rd of March or the 10th of April or something. And then on the day, oh, sorry, his office says he's just flown off to Brussels, or hiding under his desk, more like. And he kept that up for months and months until he fell off his yacht, and then it never happened. So after he died, I thought the least I could do was do the follow-up about how he used legal threats, as he hadn't sued over that particular thing, but had just sort of threatened, but didn't sue because he didn't need £1 million. I decided to do all the poor sods who had been sued, including Bauer, and I think we had Richard Ingrams in there and Tim Waterston, and the BBC, the threats they got when they were doing Panorama. Mark Thompson, who later became Director General, no less, who was responsible for the Panorama that annoyed Maxwell as well.
It's remarkable that Maxwell managed to get furious that he'd been compared to Ronnie Cray, and yet was perfectly happy to be an apologist for some of the worst mass murderers and tyrants in the whole of Eastern Europe.
I used to have a complete collection of his Leaders of the World series, which was these hagiographies of people like Todor Zhivkov of Bulgaria and Erich Honecker in East Germany and all the rest of them, Nikolai Ceausescu, a favourite. And they all started with an introduction by Maxwell, quite often in which he would interview the subject of the book. I mean, the whole scam was that, say it was Ceausescu, the Romanian government would pay a fortune for 10,000 copies or something and then distribute these around, at their embassies around the world to be given away. And it would start with Maxwell interviewing the Ceausescu figure or Zhivkov saying, dear Mr. President, why are you so popular with your people?
I think in the end they were role models for him in a way we didn't realise. Yes.
We were the person in the crowd at that Nicolae Ceausescu speech. We were the person who shouted out, you're a crook.
So Maxwell seemed to be able to get away with a lot of this stuff, partly because of this absolute blizzard of lawsuits, writs, injunctions, all of it that would be issued all the time. That was due to the legal framework at the time. You know, the burden of proof, if you had written about him, was on you to prove that it absolutely was not libel. How has that changed? And how would let's say Robert Maxwell came back tomorrow, would he be able to operate in the same way? Sorry, you're both so stunned and appalled by the prospect of Robert Maxwell coming back tomorrow.
No, I think it's a very good point. I mean, because libel law has changed a lot since Maxwell, partly because of Maxwell, I suspect, among other things. But if he was around today, if he was a kind of, you know, one of those big flashy tycoons, a sort of Philip Green sort of figure, he would do what they do and apply more for privacy injunctions and bring privacy actions rather than libel actions. I mean, that's what tycoons go for now. Every time they go for privacy, because they've had much more success with that. I mean, there are quite a number of tycoons we can barely mention because they've been so successful in getting injunctions of one sort or another.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think he wouldn't now go for straightforward libel because the defence is easier. You could put in a lot of claims for discovery now, which he certainly wouldn't want to comply with. And the overall structure has changed so that the balance of power is not with the litigant anymore. In those days, it was just, this will be so expensive and so overwhelmingly tiresome, your business will go bankrupt, you know, unless you're more or less mad. Nowadays, that's not the case. But as Francis says, go for privacy or commercial confidentiality, and we'd barely be allowed to write about half of it.
Remember, Maxwell's last ever writ, which was against us, we now have framed in the office. I think it was the 22nd of October, thereabouts, 1991, certainly October 1991. We'd said that he was tampering with the Mirror Pension Fund and taking...
Outrageous.
Taking pensioners' money and using it to prop up the share price of his private company, which is exactly what he was doing. And he issued this writ, and he said he was going to ask for aggravated damages because this was so hurtful and damaging, hurtful to his feelings and damaging to his reputation, to suggest, you know, that his workers, who are his principal concern, that he would do anything to jeopardise their peaceful retirement. So he was applying for about 5 grand in damages and 50 grand in... Oh, no, that was the other suit. That was what he won the previous time. He got aggravated damages that time as well. He did like his aggravated damages. No, he hadn't specified how much he wanted. He probably wanted more. But then he fell off his yacht about 2 or 3 weeks later, and so we never discovered how he was going to stand up in court with a straight face and say, no, I'm not touching the money in my workers' pension fund, because by the time it came to court, of course, all that would have emerged anyway, I suspect.
Yes, that was all out. I mean, we did put on the cover that after he died that someone was administering the last writs, which I thought was a particularly fine joke. But that was our experience of him, and I think a general experience of that there was a sort of blizzard of litigation and attempts to stop you telling any stories about him that were actually true. And I feel in the way he's come back as a lovable rogue, it shouldn't be forgotten that he wasn't that lovable.
There was the one way I did find of coping with his blizzard of threats was just to retaliate by going annoying him as much as possible. So one of the things I did in Independent on Sunday, I think it was, his lawyers said, you must give an undertaking that in future, whenever you're writing about Mr. Maxwell, you must put the story to him. And I said, yeah, only too happy. And so pretty much every week I would then ring up his poor, long-suffering spokesman, a man called Bob Cole, a very sweet man, and I would say, Mr. Cole, I've got a story I'm writing about Mr. Maxwell, so I'm obliged to get you to put it to him. He said, oh, God, what is it now? And so I tell him, well, I'm going to be writing this story saying that he hasn't paid this money, or that he has taken this money, or that he's done a business deal with this crook or this tyrant. And he said, oh, right, I suppose I better go and put it to him. And then he'd ring me back while they say, Mr. Maxwell has no comment to make. And a year or two after Maxwell died, I went round to interview the head of British Telecom. And who should be his chief PR man but this same Bob Cole? And so as he showed me, and he said, you made my life a misery for about a year. Every week I'd get this call from you, and I'd have to go in and see Mr. Maxwell and put it to him and say, Mr. Weed is now writing a story saying, and of course I would be the one who'd get it, and I would be shouted at by Maxwell and sworn at, and then I'd have to go back and say, Mr. Maxwell does not wish to comment, but he commented to me all right.
It's amazing what you found out afterwards. I remember going to a private eye lunch, and this was after Maxwell had wept in court at the suggestion that Private Eye had once run a lookalike of Eichmann and the Duke of Edinburgh. I mean, it wasn't actually about him at all, but this had driven Maxwell to tears in the dock. And at the time, Peter Cook had written me a note saying, gets out onion. And I'd laughed and obviously not believe Maxwell, but people had said this was extraordinary callous, and it was Maxwell had been genuinely moved. Anyway, I was sitting next to a man at lunch, and he said, oh, yes, I met Maxwell after that. He was incredibly proud of that performance. And he said to me, forget RADA, that was acting. The idea of him being genuine in any way is quite difficult to take.
Ian Hislop there. Thanks to him and Francis Ween. And you can discover more of the Eye's storied and sordid history with Robert Maxwell in episode 22, which discusses his production of Not Private Eye, a brilliantly named spin-off of a satirical magazine, and the infamous raid on the Mirror newspaper building. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We will be back again in a month's time with another one. In the interim, if you would like to take out a subscription to Private Eye, you can do so very easily. All you need to do is go to private-eye.co.uk, and there are large flashing lights and banners which invite you very warmly to take out a subscription, as do we all. This episode has been produced by Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, as they all are. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.